Good evening. In the news tonight, the dire situation in Haiti in the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. Few supplies and doctors in Syria's besieged city of Aleppo. The Trump-Clinton debate is short on substance. The 15th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan shows our nation at war in seven countries. And New York has lost one of its own, Brooklyn DA Kem Thompson. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Monday, October 10th, 2016. Beginning with international news, today helicopters brought some food and medicine to southwestern Haiti, devastated by Hurricane Matthew. Power is out and food and water are scarce. The surging ocean contaminated wells, making water undrinkable. The death toll has mounted to over 1,000 with fears of more cases of cholera, which already has a grip on the Caribbean nation. An ongoing cholera outbreak has already killed roughly 10,000 people and sickened more than 800,000 since 2010. According to the World Health Organization, it can take 12 hours to 5 days for cholera symptoms to appear after ingesting contaminated food or water. Besides food and water, Haitians need clothing and especially shoes because many have cut their feet or stepped on old nails in the scattered debris. The UN has launched a $120 million appeal in the wake of Hurricane Matthew. The funding will cover needs for the next 3 months. At the New York City Council, Councilmember Mathieu Eugene spearheaded a new joint task force to look at improving Haiti's emergency response infrastructure and to work with partners to find the most effective ways to help people and deliver supplies to remote locations. In Yemen, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the UN Human Rights Council to immediately establish an independent body to investigate rights abuses and other violations over there, especially following last weekend's attack on a funeral hall reportedly by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Deanne Penn reports.
Outrageous attacks in Yemen, such as airstrikes that killed at least 140 mourners at a funeral this weekend, cannot be allowed to continue, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has said. Zayd Raad al-Hussein on Monday reiterated his call for an independent international inquiry into alleged violations of international humanitarian law in the country. He said this latest incident, which took place in the capital Sana'a on Saturday, came just weeks after the UN Human Rights Council dismissed his call to create the investigative body for the second consecutive year. Zayd pointed out that weddings, marketplaces, hospitals, and schools have also been hit in the conflict between government forces, backed by a Saudi-led coalition, and Houthi rebels. More than 4,000 civilians have been killed in Yemen since fighting escalated in March 2015. The human rights chief said casualty figures have risen dramatically since the collapse of a cessation of hostilities agreement in August. In September, 379 people were killed and injured, while he said the figure stands at 369 for the first 10 days of October. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
In Istanbul, leaders of Turkey and Russia have overseen the signing of a deal to build a gas pipeline from Russia, a project that was suspended amid tensions between the two countries. The agreement came today on the sidelines of the World Energy Congress being held in Istanbul. Finance ministers from nations using the euro single currency gave their green light today for new loans to Greece to help bolster its debt-stricken economy. At talks in Luxembourg, the ministers agreed that the leftist government in Athens has met enough reform conditions to qualify for another 2.8 billion euro, that's $3.1 billion, of bailout funds. Doctors Without Borders is pleading for access to treat the wounded in the rebel-held part of Syria's Aleppo as government forces pressed ahead with an offensive that killed hundreds of people in recent weeks. The international charity, it's also known by the French acronym MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, said in a statement that medical workers in Aleppo are exhausted, that the overstretched facilities face an impending fuel shortage. MSF, which supports 8 hospitals in Aleppo's besieged eastern quarter, says just 35 doctors remain in the area, serving a population of 275,000. In Johannesburg, one of South Africa's top universities descended into violence today, with police firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon at stone-throwing students who are locked in a bitter national dispute with administrators and the government. This over demonstrators' demands for free education. In campaign news, the second debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump Sunday night is being seen as one of the ugliest in presidential campaign history. A sniffling Trump threw repeated punches at Clinton, and she called him out for bragging about sexually assaulting women. No real substance was discussed to persuade undecided voters. A CNN poll of debate watchers found that even though most voters thought Trump did better than they thought he'd do, they declared Clinton the winner. A YouGov poll also showed Clinton winning. The debate came after the release on Friday of a 2005 tape where Trump brags about sexually assaulting women. And more from Trump on the Howard Stern show surfaced on Saturday, where he objectifies his own daughter and he brags about his ability as a boss to ogle naked beauty contestants. Also on Friday, WikiLeaks released emails from Clinton campaign chair John Podesta with transcripts of Clinton's paid speeches. These came after the U.S. government publicly blamed the Russian government for cyber attacks on U.S. political organizations like the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. They showed that the DNC conspired against the Bernie Sanders campaign. That Russia was behind the leaks is a claim Clinton repeated at the debate Sunday evening.
Our intelligence community just came out and said in the last few days that the Kremlin, meaning Putin and the Russian government, are directing the attacks, the hacking on American accounts to influence our election. And WikiLeaks is part of that, as are other sites where the Russians hack information. We don't even know if it's accurate information, and then they put it out. We have never in the history of our country been in a situation where an adversary, a foreign power, is working so hard to influence the outcome of the election. And believe me, they're not doing it to get me elected. They're doing it to try to influence the election for Donald Trump. Now, maybe because he has praised Putin, maybe because he says he agrees with a lot of what Putin wants to do, maybe because he wants to do business in Moscow, I don't know the reasons. But we deserve answers, and we should demand that Donald release all of his tax returns so that people can see what are the entanglements and the financial relationships
we're going to get to that later.
That he has
Secretary
with
Clinton,
Russians
you're
and
out
other
of time.
Foreign powers.
Well, I think I should
Mr.
respond
Trump.
Because it's so ridiculous. I don't know, Putin. I think it would be great if we got along with Russia because we could fight ISIS together as an example. But I don't know, Putin. But I notice anytime anything wrong happens, they like to say the Russians. She doesn't know if it's the Russians doing the hacking. Maybe there is no hacking, but they always blame Russia. And the reason they blame Russia is because they think they're trying to tarnish me with Russia. I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia, but I know nothing about the inner workings of Russia. I don't deal there. I have no businesses there. I have no loans from Russia.
Meanwhile, this morning, WikiLeaks released a second batch of private emails from Clinton campaign manager John Podesta. Kevin Gotstola is with Shadowproof.com. He says there's no specific evidence that the Russian government is responsible for stealing emails from the DNC or for the latest WikiLeaks Podesta leaks, and that the mainstream media has been repeating the allegation blaming Russia for interfering in the U.S. election.
I think that specifically, the New York Times and even the Associated Press have not done anything much to show skepticism toward this claim. And I suppose I should caveat what I'm saying and say maybe it's possible that there's someone with a connection to the Kremlin who is involved in the hacking that is going on, and perhaps that's what's leading to WikiLeaks having these documents in their hand. But there are two quick points that need to be made. One, as Julian Assange, the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, emphasizes routinely, they don't know who these sources are. The submission system is set up in such a way to conceal the identity of people who are passing on documents. So the motives of these people who are obtaining these documents remain unknown to the organization, so far as we know. And then the second point is that these people who are making these claims about Russian interference, they do not have any sort of evidence to put forward. And so they continue to repeat this for the fact that these disclosures are actually hugely negative for the Democratic Party. And so instead of addressing the contents of what are in these documents, it's easier for Hillary Clinton to just pass it off as some kind of a Russian conspiracy.
Scott Stolas says this is a very alarming way to marginalize journalism you don't like.
And it doesn't bode well for us as a country if this is a preview of what it's going to be like when Hillary Clinton is president. I mean, how many of us are going to face, if we're journalists, the critique from a Hillary Clinton White House that some kind of damning revelations, some very damaging revelations that are obtained by WikiLeaks or any other organization are in fact a product from the Kremlin or Putin, whoever they want to blame it on. I mean, it could even one day wake up and find that they're blaming China or they're blaming Iran or they're blaming some other country just because they have interests in this information.
With Election Day less than a month away, Gottstola says it's basically Clinton's election to lose.
And then it's on people who listen to your radio station. It's up to people who are progressives or liberals to determine what kind of a presidency Hillary Clinton's going to have and whether it's going to embrace some of the Bernie Sanders agenda or whether it's going to be standard status quo politics and maybe a little bit of incremental change.
Meanwhile, Russia bashing goes on as the U.S. continues to be engaged in at least 7 wars overseas. The war in Afghanistan has been going on for 15 years. Former CIA analyst and peace activist Ray McGovern reminds us how we first got into Afghanistan.
Well, our involvement began big time under Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter. He said, let's give the Russians a bloody nose in Afghanistan, and sure enough, the way to do that was to recruit religious Islamic extremists, the Mujahideen, to attack the Russians in Afghanistan. Worked like a charm. The Russians left, but then guess what happened? The Mujahideen didn't really realize that they're supposed to always follow our orders. Osama bin Laden, one of them, well, you know what he did right here in this city. And so...
No, I don't know what he did. Well, I don't know that it was him who did that in this city.
Yeah, you know, this is a legitimate question. I despise people who call others conspiracy theorists when others are just trying to find out the real story. Mm-hmm. The 9/11 Commission report was a cover-up. You don't have to believe McGovern about that. The two co-chairmen of that report, Governor Kaine of New Jersey and Lee Hamilton, the Democrat they trot out for such occasions, wrote a book 2 years after the report and said, we were set up to fail. This is a quote, okay? We were set up to fail. We were not given enough time. We were not given enough money. We were not given enough access to sensitive materials. We were set up to fail. Period, end quote. Well, isn't that nice? So you're quite right. Whether Osama bin Laden was mostly responsible for 9/11 or not, surely we had some involvement by some religious extremists and others who mostly came out of Saudi Arabia. Now, what I was starting to say is simply this. And now we know what a monster we have created. And instead of finding ways to get out of this impossible situation, the people who seem to be running our policy, and they're not in the White House, they happen to be in the Pentagon, witness what's happened recently in Syria, they see a lot of profit in getting a new promotion, another star on their lapel, and the military-industrial complex is delighted.
So getting back to how this started, it was 9/11.
It was 9/11 that made us, George Bush elected, and Dick Cheney, to use as the pretext to go into Afghanistan. Now, most of us at that time were persuaded that, number one, it was bin Laden. Number two, he did have training camps in Afghanistan. And it seemed a reasonably sensible thing to go in there and eradicate those bases. What happened, of course, is after they did that, then they decided to topple the government, and then they decided to create the kind of chaos that has existed there ever since October 7th, 2001. And I remember that day clearly. We are marking here the 15th anniversary of that day, which started as a sort of a police action to destroy Osama bin Laden's camps and extended into a regime change type of operation that we have since seen in Iraq, in Libya, and we're about to see in Syria, if the Pentagon people have their head and our president has not the guts. In other words, if he still is a wuss and says, well, all right, okay, we'll go ahead, then we're really in a real problem, because you know what? The Russians have thrown down the gauntlet. Last week, their defense ministry spokesperson said, we have air supremacy over Syria. We have very fancy weapons that shoot down planes or other flying objects, even in the middle of the night, okay? Tell the former acting CIA director that we can do that in the middle of the night, okay? So, you Americans, you brag about having these stealth things that can creep in and nobody notices. Well, we notice, okay? And we don't care what it is. If it's flying, if it's not cleared with us, it's going to be shot down. So I hope that you guys will realize that. Now, that is new. That is throwing down the gauntlet. The Russians are fed up. The question is, will Obama have the strength of character? Will he have the guts, in other words, to say to the Pentagon, look, I really don't want to get in a war with Russia, so stand down. Will he do that? Well, I suppose he will. But will the Pentagon obey him? I suppose it won't, just like it didn't after his Secretary of State worked out a painstakingly clear agreement with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov of the Russians, which provided for a ceasefire beginning on the 12th of September, just last month, and which was violated by the U.S. Air Force, which attacked Syrian army troops 5 days later, namely on the 17th of September, killed 83 Syrian troops, wounded 100 more, and that scuttled a ceasefire. Why do I point that out? Well, because that was not under the orders of the President of the United States. And the Foreign Minister of Russia said, you know, who really is running this? This is a direct quote, does the U.S. Army obey its commander-in-chief? Well, if it does, it wouldn't have done that kind of thing. If it doesn't, well, we are in real deep kimchi because the Russians have now thrown down the gauntlet.
Former CIA analyst and peace activist Ray McGovern. Turning to local news, there's a great deal happening in New York City politics. Ben Max from Gotham Gazette has a rundown of what to watch this week.
Mayor Bill de Blasio begins this week facing questions about his approach to the press, including his recent barrage against the New York Post, calling it a propaganda right-wing rag. De Blasio has been under greater scrutiny for limiting the amount of times per week that he's taking questions from the press corps and also limiting some press conferences to on-topic only questions. The mayor is being criticized from many corners, including the New York Times editorial board, about the frequency with which he's taking questions and his refusal to answer questions from the New York Post at his most recent press conference. On Monday at the Columbus Day Parade, de Blasio ignored questions from many reporters gathered, but did do interviews with two outlets on the side. While we don't know what the mayor's schedule will look like in full this week, he is scheduled to do a morning speech at the Association for a Better New York on Friday, and it's supposed to be education-themed. The mayor is also expected to possibly participate in a U.S. Conference of Mayors event in New York City on Thursday afternoon that will focus on what cities need from the federal government, and it will include mayors from around the country as well as representatives from the Trump and Clinton presidential campaigns. Other New York City political events to watch this week include new NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill giving a speech Tuesday morning in front of the Association for a Better New York before it hosts de Blasio on Friday. There's also a lot going on at the City Council this week, though things are quiet for the Yom Kippur holiday, which begins Tuesday evening and extends through Wednesday. At the City Council on Thursday is one of the Council's two full-body stated meetings of September. at which new bills are introduced and bills that have passed through committee are voted on by the full council and headed to the mayor's desk. Those are a few things to watch for this week. You can find more at Gotham Gazette. For WBAI, this is Ben Max.
In other news, following revelations that the former president of City College stole money for personal expenses over a four-year period, CUNY said it is seeking a comprehensive investigation by the state. Rebecca Miles has more.
On Sunday, the City University of New York called on the state to investigate just days after the City College president, Lisa Coico, stepped down amid a federal investigation into alleged financial misconduct. Coico headed the university in 2010 and was its first graduate to serve as president. She's been accused of taking $136,000 from a school-related foundation and using it for personal expenses. According to the allegations, Coico used $65,000 on furniture, $20,000 as a security deposit on a Westchester home, and $51,000 worth of other expenses. CUNY officials had retroactively permitted the spending, but required her to repay the money, according to the New York Post. The CUNY board chair, William Thompson, in a letter to the New York Inspector General, said Coico had improperly used money 4 years ago from the 21st Century Foundation, a non-profit tied to the college. Coico was told by a CUNY lawyer to return the funds, but the college discovered that in fact she hadn't. Coico resigned on Friday. Her resignation came in the wake of an investigation into her finances, according to university officials. Coico's resignation comes during a troubled year for CUNY. Its faculty reached an agreement with the school's administration over the summer, giving instructors their first new contract in nearly 7 years. Earlier in the year, city and state officials clashed with Governor Andrew Cuomo over his proposal to cut state funding for the university. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
And finally, Brooklyn District Attorney Ken Thompson has died from cancer. Thompson was the first Black Brooklyn DA. He was elected in 2013, unseating longtime DA Charles Hines. Colleagues say cancer was diagnosed in August. During his time in office, Thompson worked at reform. He created a unit dedicated to overturning wrongful convictions and Begin Again. That's a program which gives amnesty to those with outstanding warrants. Thompson's office helped people with misdemeanors get second chances. It created gun buyback sessions for people to turn in guns, no questions asked, and it stopped prosecuting low-level marijuana arrests. His prosecution of NYPD officer Peter Liang in the 2014 shooting death of Akai Gurley led to a manslaughter conviction, but Thompson faced mounting pressure when he recommended no jail time for the rookie cop. He stirred anger and resentment among Gurley's family, police reform advocates, and community members. Ken Thompson would have faced re-election next year. Governor Cuomo may now name a replacement. Cuomo said Ken was a dedicated public servant who embodied the highest principles of the law. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams said Thompson was more than a colleague. Ken was my friend, he said. I'm honored to be beside him in the storied history of Brooklyn as the first African Americans to hold borough-wide office. Adams goes on saying, I know that many young men and women will reach a bit higher because of the heights that Ken reached in his career and his life. Ken Thompson was 50 years old. He is survived by his wife of 17 years and 2 children. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, October 10th, 2016. The news was produced with Deanne Penn, Ben Max, Rebecca Miles, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.